You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond, grassroots community-supported solar-powered radio broadcasting from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and my mom, Caroline, couldn't be with us today, but she'll be back on the air with us next week. We have a guest today who is, living the dream of every wannabe author, in that she has, I believe, she's on her fifth book in print at a very young age and having some great success. And we're really interested in finding out how she did it. Marie Lu is the author of the New York Times best-selling Legend series. She spends her spare time reading, drawing, playing Assassin's Creed, and getting stuck in traffic because she lives in L.A., where my daughter lived for 5 years, so I know what that's like, with one husband, one Chihuahua mix, and two Pembroke Welsh Corgis. And the book that we're talking about today is book two in the Young Elites series, and it's the title of it is The Rose Society. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Marie.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on the show.
So, Marie, tell us how you got your start as a writer.
I started writing from a pretty young age. I came over to the States from China when I was five, and I technically started writing because my mom gave me an assignment to go to school every day and write down English words and put them in paragraphs so that I could learn the language. So technically that was why I started writing. And once I figured out enough words to know what to do with them, I realized that I just enjoyed that process of telling stories. So I started writing stories on my own just for fun. And I've been doing that ever since. I started writing more seriously starting in high school. That was when I realized that, you know, real people wrote books. They weren't just like random names stamped on books for no reason. And at that point, that was when I started writing with a goal of getting published.
Well, I read some of your blog, and you talk about as a child, you didn't realize that you didn't understand the concept of publishing. You thought all the books in the library were sort of created by the author. Is that true?
Yeah, because when I was a kid, we didn't have any young adult author or any authors going through the school. I never met like an author in person, so I don't know. I thought about them as like a clothing brand or something, you know, like Calvin Klein going out of this assembly line factory, which, you know, Calvin Klein's a real person and everything, but like I didn't think about him that way. So that was kind of how I saw the names on books. It never occurred to me that a human must write this in order for it to be published. I don't know why it never really crossed my mind. And it wasn't until I read a newspaper article about this girl who was 13 years old and had gotten a book deal with a major New York publisher that I was like, oh, this is like an industry that you can write into. And at that point, that was when I realized I would love to be a published writer.
So you always wanted to be a writer, but you didn't go to college for that, right?
No, I didn't. I went to college to study biology and political science. I thought I was going to be a doctor or a lawyer, but, you know, obviously that didn't didn't go that way. But it was always something that I did on the side, writing. And I always hoped that I would end up in the industry in some way.
So when did you take the plunge and submit your first manuscript for publication?
I was 14 when I submitted my first manuscript. It was horrible, just awful. This horrible Lord of the Rings ripoff novel that I wrote. And I sent it off to about 100 literary agents. And I got back 100 rejection letters. Nobody even wanted to ask for sample chapters because they could tell from my query letter that it was just awful. So that was the very first one I submitted.
So, yeah. And you were only 14?
I was 14 at the time, yeah.
Did you find that discouraging?
No, I don't think so. I didn't think too hard on it. I think it's because that first article that I ever read about a published author, and it happened to be about an author who got a book deal as a 13-year-old. It was this girl named Amelia Atwater Rhodes, who I think is still writing today. And I think because I read that, it never occurred to me that it would be any sort of barrier to entry, my age. So I just thought, well, you know, I guess everybody must be in their teens when they start submitting their stuff. So I thought it was like a natural thing.
But did getting 100 rejection letters slow you down?
It did make me stop and think, okay, maybe it's harder to get published than I thought. I don't know why I thought, like, this is going to be easy. And I started sending my stuff out, and then after that I realized, like, oh, my writing's actually really awful. I should probably write a different book and try to get better. So it didn't discourage me so much that first time, but with a second manuscript that I wrote a second one when I was around 16 or 17, and that one got me an agent, but he started sending it out, and over the course of about a year and a half or so, it was rejected by every publisher you can think of. And that one hit me a lot harder than the first one did, mainly because, you know, I felt like I had taken a step forward by getting an agent, and then, you know, it didn't go anywhere.
Right, because, you know, the conventional wisdom is that getting an agent is harder than getting published. You know,
that's what I thought. I thought, oh, now that I have an agent, the rest should be a piece of cake, which it wasn't. It was like another huge, huge hurdle. And then the problem was after that, I wrote a third novel because it bothered me so much. I couldn't concentrate on writing something new while that was getting rejected. So I wrote a third novel that was kind of half-assed, and I gave it to my agent, and my agent hated it, and so he dropped me as a client. And then I felt like I moved forward, and then I had taken a huge step back. And I ended up in this spot where, you know, I had no manuscript and had no agent. And I felt like I had kind of wasted my time and that, you know, maybe I wasn't good enough to be a writer. So I got very emo about the whole thing around manuscript failure number 3.
Wow. And what kept you writing?
After that third one, I stopped writing for a couple of years. This was in college. And I thought, you know, maybe I'm not. This is not what I'm cut out to do with my life. You know, clearly I've been rejected hundreds of times at this point, and, you know, maybe I'm just not good enough to be a professional writer. So I stopped for a while, and I thought, you know, maybe this is just something that I did in my childhood. And it took me starting to work in the video game industry. That was my first job out of college, to get my inspiration back. When I left college, I actually ended up working at Disney for a few years as an artist, and that was a huge change for me because this was the first time in my life that I was now surrounded by other young people who were just like me, who were interested in the creative arts, which I had not, I had not been surrounded by a lot of people like that growing up, and this was the first time that I was working in a creative arts industry. And because of that, because I was immersed in it day and night, I felt the itch to start writing again. Like new story ideas started coming to me, and so I started getting back into, you know, writing at night. And I think because I had gone through so many rejections at that point, I think at that point I had accumulated probably 600 or so rejection letters in this stack in my closet.
You kept them all.
Like, they stopped mattering after a while because there were so many of them. You know, a new one would come in. I'm like, oh, just another white envelope with my stamp on it. I'll just put it in the corner with the others. I think it helped build up, like, a shell of tolerance. So it didn't bother me as much anymore. So I sent out, like, a fourth manuscript, which got me a new agent. But that one still got rejected. But because it didn't bother me so much, I could concentrate on writing a new book. So Legend happened to be manuscript number 5, and that one finally sold.
Wow. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is New York Times bestselling author Marie Lu, and her new book is titled The Rose Society, a young elites novel. So, Marie, even though you're still very young, and you may seem like an overnight success, that's the truth is somewhat different, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I've had a couple of people say, like, what does it feel like to be, you know, an overnight success? And I'm like, well, it took, like, a night and 12 years to get there. So not really an overnight success.
So you started very young, but you still paid your dues.
I still have like an envelope with all of the rejection letters somewhere in my closet. Every now and then, when I, you know, I feel like the angst never really stops. You know, I still panic about my writing and worry if people are going to like it. And I don't think that ever really changes, at least not for me. So when I get really panicky, I need to go back and look at some of the rejection letters and be like, okay, it's going to be okay. You know, just finish the manuscript and take it a step at a time.
Now, I'm curious as to how you went from, you know, thinking you're studying biology, working towards being a doctor, to your first job as an artist. Where did that jump? How did that occur?
It's a pretty big jump. I, just like with writing, I had been drawing and playing video games a lot ever since I was very, very young. It was just one of those things that I loved to do. But like with writing, I didn't know that was a career option. I didn't know that you could actually make money being an artist in the gaming industry. That just wasn't an option that I thought about. And so when I went off to study biology and political science, I thought, you know, the general advice I was given was, you know, you pick something that's safe, that will put food on the table, and, you know, things like drawing and video games and writing, those are things that for some reason I thought were relegated to childhood. Like, that was something that I was not to do as an adult, which was like this weird idea that I had all throughout college. And towards the end of college, I realized that I love my classes, but I couldn't picture myself in the career of a doctor or lawyer. It just didn't fit my personality at all. And so I was walking around campus on one of the last days of school in college, just feeling very emo about the whole thing, and deciding, like, do I want to go to law school? Do I not want to go to law school? And I walked past this kiosk on campus that had a bulletin on it. And the bulletin was from Disney Interactive Studios, which is the video game division of Disney. And it said at the top, it said, do you like to play video games? Which, of course, I did. And so I read the second line, and it said, do you like to draw? Which, of course, I did. And I read the rest of it. It said, you know, well, we're looking for 8 interns to join us for 6 months. You'll be paid. And all you're going to do for 6 months is to come up with video game ideas.
Whoa!
Yeah. And I was like, that sounds like the most amazing job I've ever heard of in my life. I didn't know you could do that and actually make money doing it. So I remember just running, literally running back to my dorm room and looking up this internship and applying for it. And I submitted like a little portfolio of art that I had done in the past, and I started working in the game industry, and I stayed on for several years, and it was just felt like serendipity, you know. It was just like this thing that fell into my life, and I didn't even realize that it would have been a part of my life.
Wow. Now, did your family, were they pushing you towards like a more stable career, and were they a little surprised at the turn that this took?
They were definitely surprised. They weren't, you know, incredibly forceful about it or anything, but, you know, I've come from like an immigrant family, and the immigrant mentality is like, you don't starve in the new country. Like, that's the goal. That's why we come, is to make sure you don't starve under a bridge. So they wanted to make sure that I was going to be okay, that I was able to take care of myself, and that I would be in something that was stable. So my mom suggested, you know, she's like, you know, just so you know, like, you can absolutely do all the stuff that you love, but we're not totally convinced that these are actual careers. So, you know, make sure you study something that you can use to actually have a, you know, make a living doing in college. And so that was, you know, and it's very solid advice. It made sense to me, and that's why I went off to do it. I remember when I found out about the internship, I had gotten into law school, but I hadn't sent in the acceptance packet yet. And so I called my mom on the phone, and I told her about it. I was like, well, you know, there's, like, this video game job that I just heard about 2 seconds ago. Sounds really, really cool that I would love to do. And I remember saying, like, I don't feel like I'm going to be happy, you know, going to law school and becoming a lawyer. I just had this mental image of, like, looking into this future of doing something. I just didn't, my heart wasn't in it. And I think my mom could hear that in my voice, because, you know, she was very hesitant about the whole thing. She's like, what, the video game industry? Like, is that an industry at all? But she said, you know, if this is something that you really, really feel strongly about, then you should go ahead and do it. Like, we don't want you to be unhappy. Mm-hmm. You know, we want you to be happy. Just, you know, do what you need to do. And I'm sure in the back of their heads they're also like, oh my gosh, shouldn't we live in our basement for the next 20 years? but it turned out okay. Now she's very excited about everything that's happening.
Oh, I bet.
But I remember at the time it was a bit of a shock to, because it was such a pivot, and it just shocked me as well, where I was like, oh my God, it was kind of frightening to think that I had studied all this stuff, and now I was going to do something that was completely different from everything that I had studied.
Well, I bet that everything that you learned actually helps you, you know, understanding biology. I could see where you could help, that could help, or and political science too, in designing video games. You know, it's not.
That's the funny thing is a lot of that came back into my writing.
I bet.
Many times. Yeah, especially the political science. It's showed up in almost every single one of my books, just because I do find politics fascinating. And I do find science fascinating. I just didn't want to do those as jobs.
Right.
Yeah, and that's the great thing about being a writer is you can come from any walk of life. Like, so many of my writer friends did not study creative writing in school or anything like that. They came from all walks of life, and I think we're just united by the passion of writing and practicing writing and putting all of our life experiences and knowledge into what we're writing. So it's definitely not something that I regret. I'm very, very glad that I ended up taking those classes.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Marie Lu, the author of The Rose Society, a young elite's novel. And am I correct that this is your fifth published book?
Yes. Technically it's my sixth. I wrote a middle grade novel as part of a Scholastic series with a bunch of other authors.
But okay.
This is the fifth book that's actually mine, yeah.
And all of them have been published as young adult fiction? Mm-hmm. Is that true? And why did you decide to write that type of work as opposed to adult sci-fi fantasy?
I didn't actually know that there was a distinction when I started. When I was in high school, this was, you know, before the term YA became an official thing. I was reading, you know, exclusively fantasy and sci-fi, and I feel like fantasy and sci-fi, it has a young adult feel to it to begin with. A lot of fantasy, you know, the traditional fantasies like Terry Brooks' Shannara series, Robert Jordan series, Tolkien, a lot of, like, Ender's Game, a lot of those, if they were published today, would be published under a YA. You know, a lot of those protagonists were 15, 16, 17 years old, going on these epic quests that basically symbolize, you know, the coming of age.
Right.
So I feel like reading those genres kind of predisposed me to writing about the young adult experience. So I started writing that kind of story when I was a young adult, and I just ended up staying in there. It's such an interesting time period in a person's life for me to explore, because everything is changing, and it pairs really well with fantasy and science fiction, because, you know, in those worlds, the outside is changing along with the main character who is also going through this coming of age. So when I first pitched Legend to my agent, I didn't actually know that I was pitching young adult. I gave it to her as a science fiction book, and she was the one who came back and said, this actually fits very neatly into young adult science fiction.
Right, and which,
great,
you know,
yeah.
Starting with Harry Potter, but then also moving into the Hunger Games books and the Insurgent books, that's really kind of probably the hottest genre in publishing right now.
Yeah, I mean, some of the best books that I've read in the last few years have been young adults, and it's almost exclusively what I read now. It's such a bright spot in the publishing industry, and it's really, really nice to see this golden age of books for young readers that can also cross over to an adult audience. It's really nice to see that.
Now, the Young Elites series has been described as Game of Thrones meets X-Men. Would you agree with that description?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate description. The X-Men part comes in because a lot of the the young people have superpowers and they band together, it's just happening in a fantasy era, in like a Renaissance era Italy. The original idea was I wanted to create something where the equivalent of the Black Death has swept through this version of this fantasy version of our world, and as a result, the people who survive and come out of it, some of them come out of that illness with strange powers, supernatural powers. And no one during that era knew what to do with people that were different. So I drew very much from the historical facts of, like, back then, if people thought you were a witch, they just burned you at the stake because you were terrifying to them. Mm-hmm. And if you actually really did have powers back then, they would have hunted you down. The Inquisition would absolutely have not been okay with that, and they would have been seen as demonic. So it's a little bit of Game of Thrones, a little bit of X-Men mixed together. So I think that's a pretty accurate description.
Now, is the world Earth?
The world is not Earth. It's in an alternate fantasy world that's inspired by Earth.
Okay.
So the main country that most of the events are happening in is an island nation that's inspired by Renaissance Italy. So a lot of the names are Italian. The language is very Italian. And a lot of the culture is based on Renaissance-era Italy. So there's bits and pieces that feel very much like real Earth, but it's not actually Earth.
And how much research did you do into that time period?
I did as much as I'm still actually doing research on it, since I'm still going through and writing the series. So I bought a lot of books on everyday life in Renaissance Italy. That was the kind of thing I was interested in. Like, what did people eat every day? What was breakfast like? What was the marketplace like? How did you buy fruit? What were the holidays and so on? So it was all very, very interesting to read. And I feel like all writers are on some kind of CIA blacklist because of the things that we look up online. So I did a lot of that. Just the most random Google searches for random information that I needed at the time.
Well, it must be really, in a way, very fun to do a fantasy based on a historical period as opposed to a flat-out historical novel, because with a historical novel, if you don't get the details accurate,
mm-hmm.
and you can't do things that didn't fit, but with this, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, that was one thing that I had a lot of fun with. And I'm sure that a lot of fantasy writers have fun with, because you get to, you know, put in the fun stuff about history, just like, oh, this stuff actually really happened in the past. And then you get to put in, like, dragons and magic, and you get to play with this alternate version of Earth. It is very fun to be able to take the best of both worlds.
Well, let's go back to your first series, the Legend series. Mm-hmm. Where was that set?
Legend is science fiction, so it was set in a dark, futuristic, flooded version of Los Angeles, which is where I live. And I was originally inspired to write that world because I was reading an article online, and there was a really fascinating, accurately simulated map of what the world will look like in about 100 years or so, when all of our freshwater ice has melted and the oceans have risen by 100 meters.
Whoa.
It was an absolutely fascinating map. It was scientifically accurate. And just to look at it and see that, like, Europe was pretty much gone. Australia was two Australias. The entire southeastern United States was underwater, from Florida up to D.C. And so I was looking at California, since that was where I lived. And there was this huge lake that stretched from L.A. all the way up to San Francisco. And I guess my first thought was, like, it would be really cool to flood my city and set a novel on that. So that's where I got the inspiration for that setting.
How about the characters? Where did they come from?
The characters for Legends, there were two main characters in Legends. And their point of views go back and forth throughout the entire series. And they were originally inspired by Les Miserables. I was watching the old movie version of Les Miserables one afternoon back in 2009 or so. This was the one with Liam Neeson in it, so like the not the new one that came out. And I was watching it and just enjoying it. And then all of a sudden I had this thought, you know, hey, it would be really fun to write a teen version of a criminal being hunted down by a detective, like both of them being teenagers, prodigies in their own right. And I just loved everything about that idea, and I put it off in the corner of my mind for a few weeks, just to let it stew around. And then that was when I saw the article with the map in it. So I put those two things together, and that's how I started writing about the characters. So they were originally inspired by Jean Valjean and Javert.
And this was, you started writing after having not written for quite a few, for several years. Is that correct?
Well, I was on submission with a fourth manuscript at that point.
Okay.
The fourth manuscript, this one was one that never got published, was the one that I had written after several years of not writing.
Okay.
So I was in the middle of getting rejection letters for manuscript number four, and to take my mind off of that, I was working on a new novel, and that happened to be Legend.
Now, Marie, when you look back at those earlier manuscripts, mm-hmm. how do you perceive them today?
I am very glad that nobody will read them, and they're sort of buried in the eons of time. Well, the eons of the internet, I guess. Hopefully they won't be unearthed anytime soon. I'm glad that they are not going to be read, that they weren't published, because I can look back and see how bad they were. But I don't regret writing them. I think I learned a lot from each one of them. And actually, bits and pieces of those old manuscripts have ended up in my published books. Things that I thought were good or liked or characters that I wanted to keep. Like one of the two main characters from Legend, this boy named Day, was actually a character that was in one of my novels from high school. So even though the book was not good enough to be published, I still liked that character a lot, and he ended up making it into one of my later books. So, you know, I think there's always things that one can salvage from old manuscripts and interesting ways that old things pop up into new writing.
Well, you know, there are quite a few very successful authors whose early books did not get published, and sometimes after they become famous, mm-hmm. they're published later. I'm thinking of John Grisham's first manuscript was published subsequently to many of his others. But I wonder if he went back and did revision, you know, from a, you know, later on. I don't know if he did or not. And then, of course, Harper Lee with,
right.
you know,
right.
To Kill a Mockingbird was actually her second manuscript. The first one has just now been published. And it's really interesting to see, I think that, what is it called, The Watchmen, I think?
Ghost at a Watchmen, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it was really wonderful, that it was still really wonderfully yeah. written. But I do agree that the best way to improve your writing is to write. And
absolutely.
And getting rejected can be a good learning experience.
Yeah. I think there's no such thing as, you know, writing that's wasted. I think what the general saying is you write, there goes my book, you write 500,000 words before you can write something that is publishable. And I think that's a pretty accurate way of looking at it, because I think I wrote about 500,000 words
wow.
before I was able to write Legends. So wow. I don't think any of it is ever wasted. It's just us practicing what we're doing.
And the truth is that most people are going to give up before they get to the 500,000, before they get that proficiency.
Right. Yeah. 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 I think that's really what separates unpublished writers from published writers, is that one just ends up sticking it out longer. It's not, I mean, there's talent involved, but I think a lot of it is practice.
Now, did you ever consider, when you were trying to get published, you know, and you had enough success to get an agent, but you were getting rejections, did you ever consider self-publishing?
I that's an interesting question, because when that was happening, self-publishing wasn't a thing yet.
Mm.
This was back in early 2000 or so, 2001, 2002. And I mean, you could self-publish, but it was much harder than it is now.
Right.
So I don't know. I would be really curious to see what would happen if I went back in time and, or, you know, if I was in that process, in this day and age and what I would be doing. I imagine that I would probably have been uploading my stuff on Wattpad or Tumblr or something, just like a lot of teens do today, and getting feedback that way. And I think that's a really, really different, very interesting landscape. And I don't know, I might have gone the self-publishing route. I'm glad that I didn't, looking back, just because I know that those novels weren't really fully fleshed out yet.
Right.
But, but I think it's a really, really interesting option now, and very, very good in a lot of ways for a lot of writers, depending on how much control you want to have and what you're looking for.
Well, you're right. And of course, the great thing about self-publishing is anyone can publish a book, and the bad thing about self-publishing is anyone can publish a book.
Right, exactly.
And the issue is that, first of all, as a self-published author, it can be difficult to attract an audience. Whereas if you do get a mainstream publisher, there is at least some built-in distribution channels, you know, that are, mm-hmm. you know, that you will be able to feed into. But the other thing is, you know, what you basically just alluded to was that your book may not really be ready for publication. And by self-publishing a book that is not your best work, you can be shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah, it's a tricky line to walk because, you know, even now, I can never really be sure that my writing is good enough to be published until I'm told that it is. You know, I need, like, an outsider to tell me that. So I think the best self-published authors know that they must still run their work through a professional editor of some kind to help them polish it to be the absolute best. I think it's a mistake when people assume that self-publishing is just the easier way of getting published. And I don't think that is true at all. You know, it's readers are not stupid. You know, readers can tell if something's not a good story. And so you let the readers decide, ultimately, whether or not they like something. So I think if people choose the self-publishing route, they have to know what they're getting into. They have to do their research to know everything there is to know about the self-publishing industry because it's just so different. The things that you have control over are so, there's just so many more things that one has to go through. Like, they have to be in control of their editing process and the copy editing process and making sure that you're still putting out the absolute best work
right.
you can put out.
And even
that's
things
like individual choice.
Like
yeah.
page layout, typography.
Right.
All of those
right.
really
covers,
matter.
Everything.
Yeah. And you can, if you don't have the skills yourself, which most authors aren't going to have that entire skill set, you can hire professional book cover designers, professional layout and so forth. But right. if you don't, and you'll end up with a product that doesn't look done.
Right, exactly.
And it will be hard to get people to buy it because if you pick up a book and you open it and it looks like something that came off a copy machine,
right?
You know, are you going to lay down your money for that? Probably not.
Yeah, and that's the thing either with, you know, with both published and unpublished, it needs to look professional. It needs to read professional. And I think as long as it can do that, readers will be very receptive to either one, but they both require
right.
really the same amount of effort and thought and care.
And of course, as a reader and as a reviewer and someone interviewing authors, the one thing I like about working with authors who are who have publishers is that somebody else has served as a filter. That I know when I get that book that it has at least a certain level of quality, whereas with self-published authors, I don't know for sure until I get it and read it myself. So
right.
it's more work for me.
Yeah, it's a very, very different, very new, I think, way of discovering books.
Right. But I do support a lot of self-published authors, and we do have a lot on the show, but, you know, there's pros and cons.
Yeah, I mean, there's some great stories that come out of, like, one of my favorite novels right now is The Martian by Andy Weir, and that started its life as a self-published novel, and it just rose very quickly to the top, And I think everyone just knew. They knew when they read it that it was something special.
And is that the one that was the movie that was just came out?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it just came out as a film, and you know, it's hugely popular now, and he deserves every last bit of the success that he's getting from it. It is a really, really wonderful, very different kind of science fiction novel.
Speaking of movies, do I understand that Legend is being made into a movie?
Yeah, both Legend and The Young Elites are under option with Temple Hill Productions, and they're the guys behind The Fault in Our Stars and The Maze Runner. So they're really, really great guys. The Young Elites is sitting with 20th Century Fox right now, and we just actually went through the first draft of the screenplay from my screenwriter for The Young Elites a few weeks ago. So it's pretty exciting to see.
Oh, yeah.
What's happening. Yeah.
So let's get back to The Young Elites. By the way, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers' Voices, and I'm Monica Hadley, and my guest today is Marie Lu, the author of the Legend series and the Young Elites. Her most recent book is The Rose Society, which is a Young Elites novel. So this is book two in a trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
And
in a trilogy.
I found it really interesting because the protagonist is a little bit twisted.
She's not a protagonist, really, right?
Yeah.
she's a villain. She's a bad guy.
But yeah. I'm still rooting for her.
I hope so, yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that and why you chose to write it this way.
Yeah, I actually started out writing this story thinking that I was telling it from a hero's point of view. So the main character, Adelina, was actually a side character. She was a villain in the original story, the third person villain, side character. And I wrote about 100 pages of that novel, and I gave it to my agent. And my agent, who, you know, is very wonderful, very kind, but does not sugarcoat when she doesn't like something from me, she's called me back. She called me, and she literally said on the phone, you know, when you sent this to me, did you think that it was good?
Oh, no.
Exact words.
Oh, no.
And I remember going, oh, my God, Kristen, thank you for crushing my heart forever. But I said, is there anything that you actually did like about the story? Or, you know, should I just stop being a writer completely? And Kristen said, well, I like your villain. I like this girl named Adelina. She's really interesting. And she said, can you tell me more about her? And so I said, oh, yeah, you know, I had a really fun time writing her. She's very cunning and manipulative and just evil. And she was fun to write, and I hope that, you know, if you give me another chance to write about her, that I get to keep her in the story. And Kristen just sort of half-jokingly said, well, maybe you can make her the main character. And that was what got the wheels turning in my head, that I thought, maybe I don't want to write a hero story. Maybe I want to write a villain story. So the story got totally flipped around on its side, and I took that character and made her the first person main character, except that she was still going to become a villain as the story went on. So now, you know, the final version of the story is that she is a girl who is essentially the teen girl version of Darth Vader. You know, she starts off the story as a relatively decent person and then ends up going to the dark side. And the story, the series chronicles her downfall into becoming a villain and why she goes that way.
Mm. Are there other examples that you can think of books that are written from the point of view of the villain?
There's not a lot of them. I can probably think of more movies than I can from a villain's point of view. I think that, you know, I don't want to give any spoilers away for books that people mm-hmm. might not have read yet, but there's definitely a very popular adult novel that came out recently, you know, that was a movie as well, from the point of view of a woman who ends up being a maybe not, you know, and the antagonist of the story. Mm-hmm. It's a bit of a surprise. In young adult, it's pretty rare. I think usually young adult tends to have a hallmark of having more hope in it. So even the really dark stories have that ray of hope, the ray of light that shines through, which is a really, really special thing about young adults. And so I don't think there's actually a lot of stories told from the villain's point of view in young adults.
Oh, wow.
I'm thinking through Actually, there is a series called Mara Geyer by Michelle Hodkin that I believe is told from the point of view of a girl who is the antagonist as well. So that's another series that that goes the other way. Yeah.
Now, not all of your chapters are from Adelina's point of view, right?
Right. Most of the chapters are from her point of view, but there's a couple of third-person chapters from side characters, mainly put in to show how Adelina looks from outside her head so that we have perspective. You know, from Adelina's point of view, she is the hero. She thinks that what she's doing is always right, and she can't understand why people don't understand her actions and her motives until you see her from a third-person point of view by some of these other characters, and they're like, oh my God, this girl is insane. We've got to stop her. Just to give the readers a little bit of perspective.
Well, why don't you read a little bit from the Rose Society for us?
Yeah, sure. So this is the opening chapter for the Rose Society. Rose Society is the second book in the series, and it really, this is the book that chronicles her true downfall. You know, this is the one where she lashes out against everyone who has ever wronged her in life, and she gets revenge, you know, to varying consequences. So this opening chapter is just a page long, and it's from Adelina's point of view. When I was a little girl, my mother would spend long afternoons telling me old folk tales. I remember one story particularly well. Once upon a time, a greedy prince fell in love with a wicked girl. The prince had far more than he needed, but it was never enough. When he grew ill, he visited the kingdom of the great ocean, where the underworld meets the living world, to bargain with Moritas, the goddess of death, for more life. When she refused, he stole her immortal gold and fled to the surface. In revenge, Moritas sent her daughter, the Angel of Fury, to retrieve him. She materialized out of the sea foam on a warm, stormy night, clad in nothing but silver silk, an achingly beautiful phantom in the mist. The prince ran to the shore to greet her. She smiled at him and touched his cheek. "What will you give me in return for my affection?" she asked. "Are you willing to part with your kingdom, your army, and your jewels?" The prince, blinded by her beauty and eager to boast, nodded. "Anything you want," he replied. "I am the greatest man in the world. Even the gods are no match for me." So he gave her his kingdom, his army, and his jewels. She accepted his offerings with a smile, only to reveal her true angel form, skeletal, thinned, monstrous. Then she burned his kingdom to the ground and pulled him below the sea into the underworld, where her mother was patiently waiting. The prince tried once again to bargain with the goddess, but it was too late. In exchange for the gold he'd stolen, Moritas devoured his soul. I think of the story now as I stand with my sister on the deck of a trading ship, looking toward the shore where the city-state of Moritas rises out of the morning mist. Someday, when I am nothing but dust and wind, what tale will they tell about me? Once upon a time, a girl had a father, a prince, a society of friends. Then they betrayed her, so she destroyed them all. That's the end of that segment.
And that was Marie Lu reading from the opening of The Rose Society, a young elite's novel. Was it difficult for you to write from the perspective of the villain? Did you have to go to a dark place to do that?
I did. It was incredibly difficult. just because, like, with the Legend trilogy, you know, Legend was set in a very dark world, but the people that I was writing from, you know, they were good kids with their heads on straight. They came from good families, so it was never uncomfortable for me to be in their headspace. And that was not the case with Adelina. So I had to find a way to walk that fine line of making her obviously in the wrong for most of the time, but at the same time making her sympathetic for the reader. It was a combination of trying to figure out, you know, how do I make sure that people can see the reasoning behind her thoughts? however wrong they may be. So Adelina has a very traumatic childhood. You know, she has a very, very dark past. And that absolutely sets her on the road to becoming the person that she does. And throughout it, she still has a couple of people in her life that she cares very deeply for. And I try to hang on to those pieces to remember her humanity and to help me get through her really, really dark thoughts, because she has quite a few dark thoughts. You know, she has a love-hate relationship with her sister, but she cares very, very much about her. And there's a couple other people that she goes through and really wants to find acceptance from. You know, the whole story, she's trying to find a place where she can belong, and she can't seem to do it. She's very bad at this and ends up on her own and alone and feeling very bitter that everyone's turned their backs on her. So it was very challenging to be in that headspace because it's such a dark space. I actually have a playlist on my laptop called the Evil Playlist. And every morning, like, I would have to sit down in front of my computer and put on my headphones and play, like, the Evil Playlist.
All right, what are some of the songs on the...
Like, what's that?
What are some of the songs on the Evil Playlist?
Oh, it's I think there's some Marilyn Manson on there and some, you know, stuff I don't really listen to on a daily basis, but like some very, there's like this new remix version of, what is that Eurythmics song? Sweet Dreams, like Sweet Dreams are made of this.
Yeah,
but it's like this creepy, eerie remix of it. And so I have that on there. I have some stuff from movies, you know, soundtracks that are very dark. And once I play those enough for usually like half an hour or something, I'm like, okay, I feel sufficiently evil now to write about my character. And then I have to get out of her head again at the end of the day. Otherwise, I'm just going to be sitting in the corner with a bat, just feeling very like dark in my head. So I have three dogs at home, so I had to like pet my dogs and remind myself that I'm not actually Adelina. You know, I'm just writing about this girl. So it's very difficult to find that that voice for her and keep that voice without getting really down about life, because it's hard to sustain that mental process over long periods of time.
Now, are all three books in the Young Elites series from her point of view?
Yeah, all three books are from her point of view.
Okay.
So, quite a bit.
And if somebody has not read the Young Elites, can they start with the Rose Society?
They could. I've had a couple of readers tell me that they started with the Rose Society sort of by accident. They didn't know it was a book two. And they seem to have pulled through okay. I would definitely recommend reading the first book first, just because there's so much that happens and so much of the world that is introduced in the first one that it's probably just easier to start with the first one.
Yeah, I would agree.
You can start with the second one if you really want to.
I had not read the first one, so I have started with this with the Rose Society, and I think I feel like about a third of the way in, I pretty much had the backstory, but I also was feeling like I had missed out a little bit. I understood it, but it would have been interesting to have actually read it. So I would recommend starting.
I'm glad to hear that it wasn't too confusing.
No, it wasn't too confusing. And I think in some way it probably could even stand on its own.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I hope that. I'm very, very glad to hear you say that. And hope that other readers who happen to pick up this one first are able to read it and enjoy it.
Now, this one was released quite recently. Is that true?
This came out October 13th, so about 2 months ago.
And what kind of reaction has it received?
Most people seem like, most of the readers are people who have read the first book already, so I've gotten a lot of fun reactions from them of, you know, which characters have got together with whom and how the story ended, and a lot of people who are like, "You are a very dark person." And I'm like, yes, I tried to be happy in real life. But hopefully readers are enjoying it, and I'm glad to see them following the story through.
And do you have people who are like, "Well, when's the next book coming out? I can't wait."
Yeah, I've had a couple of questions about the third book and what the title will be and what the cover will be. So, yeah, that's where I just finished the first draft of the third novel and sort of waiting for notes from my editor on it. So that's where we're sitting with it.
And do you have a publication date for it?
We don't have a publication date yet, but I'm pretty sure it's going to be coming out next fall. So it should be a fall 2016 book.
Now, of other like trilogy, sci-fi, young adult, fantasy trilogies, what are your, or not even just necessarily trilogies, because some of them, like the Game of Thrones, are much more than three books. What are your favorites?
Oh my goodness, we could talk for hours and hours. I am a huge fan of a lot of YA books. Right now, there's two that came out this fall that are just absolutely amazing. Both of them are the first books in upcoming series. One of them is called Illuminae, and it's by Amy Kaufman and Jay Kristoff. It is a science fiction book that is just fantastic. It's unlike any other YA novel or any novel that I've ever read, in that it's told like sound footage. So it's a collection of what look like secret documents that are found about this space colony that is attacked and this crew that's trying to escape. And it's told in a series of, like, hacked emails and secret government files and, you know, surveillance camera footage and so on. It's really, really cool. Very interesting. And
what was that title again?
Such a fun read. It's called Illuminae, and it's spelled I-L-L-U-M-I-N-A-E, Illuminae. And that is the first of a series. But it absolutely stands alone as well. So the ending is, like, a solid ending. And so it's a great read. And it's one of those books that is best read in hardcover edition, just because there's so much art direction that happens in it.
Mm.
I think the readers will miss out on some of it if they try to read an e-book of it. So
okay.
I definitely recommend that. Another series that's fantastic is a fantasy series. It's by Leigh Bardugo. It's called Six of Crows. Leigh is probably one of the best fantasy authors working today. Her characters are so intricate, and this is a story that is about a heist. So think Ocean's 11 meets Game of Thrones.
Ooh.
And it's about this, it's so fantastic. It's about these six characters who band together to try to pull off this heist in a fantasy world. And I don't know how she managed to develop all six of these characters in one book, but she did, and it is just a masterpiece, masterly crafted work of fiction that I think, you know, if you're a aspiring writer, absolutely recommended to see how she managed to pull this off. And for a reader, just a really, really good time.
Wow.
It's one of my favorite fantasies right now. So those are the two I can think of off the top of my head that are really, really fantastic.
And I think when I looked at your website, that if I recall correctly, you're rather a Harry Potter fan, too.
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I was part of that generation that grew up with Harry Potter as the books were coming out. So I feel very fortunate to be, you know, part of the generation that like got to go to midnight launch parties and, you know, grow up with Harry with each book.
Have you heard from J.K. Rowling yet?
If I heard from J.K. Rowling, I think I would have fainted dead in my she's a huge idol, of course, and I would love, love, love to meet her in person one day. I don't know if she will do another tour for any of her books, you know, whether adult or not, but I would so love to meet her. I hope I don't, you know, I feel like if I were to meet her, I might freak her out with being such a fangirl.
Have you read her adult?
Marie, be cool, don't freak her out.
Have you read her adult books?
I have not. I've actually got her most recent one, her Robert Galt
right
books.
Right.
Got the most recent one on my Kindle right now, and I need to go and read it, but I'm really, really looking forward to checking it out and seeing how her writing is different.
Yeah, I really quite enjoyed them, and I'm curious, do you think you will ever make the leap to a different genre?
You mean to adults?
For writing, adults or even something.
Contemporary.
Yeah,
something.
Yeah, or historical novel or anything different.
I mean, never say never, so I'm definitely open to anything. It kind of depends on, I guess, where I am with my writing career and what I feel like writing at that moment. So I can probably only speak for present day me. I could see myself going into historical fiction at some point. I feel like that would be really interesting to write. And actually, my fourth manuscript that I wrote, which ended up getting rejected, was a historical fiction, more of a historical fiction than anything else I've ever written. It was a historical fantasy novel, and it was about Mozart as a child.
Ooh.
The fact that he had a sister who was 5 years older than him, who was every bit, this is a historical fact, his sister was every bit as talented as he was in playing the piano and violin and composition. But because she was a woman during that time, women were not allowed to be composers. So she had to stop doing what she was doing when she turned 18.
Wow.
But when they were kids, historically, they toured together. And no one ever really mentions that in biographies about Mozart or stories about Mozart, but they toured together and played together for the kings and queens of Europe. So I wrote this historical fantasy based on this tiny little detail that I read in a Mozart biography. And it was about the fact that because there's these two young kids toying together, and they would spend days and days and days trapped in a carriage together with, no smartphones to entertain themselves, they made up this fantasy world called the Kingdom of Bach to entertain themselves. And they got really into it. They drew maps for it, and they had a manservant who they asked to, draw maps for them. And they made all kinds of stories set in this Kingdom of Bach. And I remember reading that in a biography, and I thought, that is so interesting. I never knew any of this. So I wrote a historical fantasy that was told from the point of view of his sister as a child, and what it was like to grow up with this enormously talented brother who was, just as talented as her, but so much more famous, and what that must have felt like, and also weaving this fantasy world that they created into their reality. So as the story goes on, as he gets older, this fantasy starts creeping into their real world more and more and more. So that's a story that I think about revisiting at some point. And
I think you should. I would love to read that. It sounds amazing.
Oh. Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that. It's one of those stories that keeps, I think about it every now and then. I'm like, I would love to revisit this, but I haven't quite found the right voice or the right writing style for it.
Well, let me know when you do, because I want to read it. And unfortunately, we are now out of time. But I want to thank you so much for being our guest on Writer's Voices today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I had a fantastic time talking to you. This is a really, really fun time.
It was great. And to all our listeners, stay tuned now for Planet Earthwild if you're listening on Friday, or our rebroadcast is 8 a.m. Monday morning. And see you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.